floor in terms of anybody who would like to put either a direct question to either of the speakers or who would like to make a particular comment, not particularly addressed to either of the speakers, but on their interpretation of either of the philosophies of which have been expounded or their own particular philosophy. I would hope to see a large number of such contributions, and therefore I would ask you, if you can, possibly to keep your contribution as brief as possible. So with that brief proviso, I'd like to throw the meeting open to the floor. I see two hands. Mr. Lewis.
I think I want to say to the questioner and to Mr. Hardy, the word infinite is complicated and subject to constant subtle changes, weather, decision making, and quarrels and troubles of every sort. And it may well be that at any one time, one country has a surplus, another country has a shortage. Take what happened recently when Russia totally failed to feed itself and had to rush to America and Canada for surplus grain. It was the surplus food in America that rescued Russia. But there are times when a country simply cannot afford, because of the level of its taxes, to buy surplus food and ship it a very, very long way away, where there are problems of distribution of getting the food to groups of people who are starving. It's all a great deal more complicated than it looks. The trouble is that many countries have neglected their own agricultural system. Many particularly poor countries, wrongly encouraged by so-called overseas aid, have put their efforts into grandiose industrial projects instead of improving their own agriculture. On the second point, education, a market economy, capitalism, will create the wealth from taxes on which can you sustain the free educational service if you so wish. I happen to think that there are other ways of organizing education than free. But take a country like Switzerland, first class educational service, better than ours, good tax revenue, exactly what we would like ours to be if only we haven't mismanaged our affairs. We have a crippled capitalism in this country. Mr. Hardy, I would say, has quite rightly criticized us, but we have to learn from our own mistakes. A country like Switzerland shows what can be done. But I do answer the questioner. It's not a very valid point. People in a market economy cannot buy what they need if they don't have decent earning power. So we have to have what is called a negative income tax to bring everybody up to a minimum level of income so they can afford to buy what they need.
Mr. Well, I would like to add one thing which seems to me to be relevant to it, to remind mind you, of course, about this difficulty of producing enough for the world's needs. And that is the very essential point is that when we talk about running the world on a cooperative socialist basis, people cooperating together, you have to remember that the enormous advantage you will have by shedding all of these institutions that are assumed to be necessary, and in fact are necessary, to capitalism. One could at a rough sort of estimate to say that if you've got rid of the armaments of the world, all the financial institutions which are necessary for buying and selling, would, and therefore for capitalism would not be necessary for socialism, you could, so to speak, double your resources for producing the things that you need, which would, of course, enormously alter the concept of producing for people in the world what people in the world need. Capitalism cannot do this. It never has done this. Capitalism has never yet produced enough for the human needs of the people of the world. And one other thing, of course, arising out of this, when one's contemplating the difficulty of doing this, remember the world doesn't stand still. The facilities for organizing administration on a local, national, world basis have enormously increased. Of course, one of the things capitalism has done, as Karl Marx pointed out in his tribute to what capitalism has done, capitalism has made socialism possible from the point of view of production. In particular, of course, it has enormously advanced means of communication. So, if you think to yourself it may be difficult to organize these things on a world basis, remember that the facilities for doing it, for all kinds of democratic administration at all levels, have been enormously improved by the development of the means of communication.
Are there any more questions? Mr. Carver.
Are all demands legitimate to make a profit? No. I would ban, the law can ban white slave trade, ban trade in hard drugs, ban trade in whatever you will. The Americans tried to ban trade in alcohol, it didn't work. No, the law can outlaw trade in any activities that can practically be enforced.
I'm going to make one very brief comment on this, of course. Whatever country you go to, any part of the world, you don't need to ask what's their largest industry. It's the killing industry, armaments. Nobody is suggesting in the market economy you're going to have a law abolishing the merchants of death who all over the world, if you've seen it in Vietnam, all of these capitalist countries pouring armaments into Vietnam and elsewhere, resulting in the death of human beings without any will on their part, and in a way which is not the slightest use to them. Socialism offers you this prospect, at least, that you will get rid of that largest industry of capitalism, the killing industry.
Do I see any more questions? Gentlemen here.
Yes, Mr. Hall has just pointed out what he's right in the form of a question. How the SDG being used does in fact capitalism cause war. He mentioned that capitalism causes crises. How does capitalism in fact cause war as well as crises? Reminding the audience that there have been two world wars. He just mentioned Vietnam. There's been a series of smaller wars since the last war, supposedly to end war and make the world safer, democracy, we were told. And if I could just take the liberty of a two-pronged question, the other one to Keith Joseph, on the question of pollution, which he said that capitalism would simply pass an accident to get rid of, could he answer the question of hydrogen bomb tests by all the major powers, Britain, the United States, Russia, France, and China, all sanctioned by Labour and Tory governments, which have polluted the entire environment of the canopy all mutually attacking?
Thank you. Mr. Harvey, would you like to answer first?
Well, on the question of wars, how capitalism causes war, or at least constantly makes war likely and periodically gets involved in it, although you talk about nations, you talk about Germany, England, France, Switzerland, whatever it may be, in fact, with capitalism, you have got, in each of these countries, people controlling manufacturing and other industries, looking for markets. And in the ordinary course of technical development of production, you get a situation in which, shall we say, the motor car industry in America becomes much too large for the American home market. They're looking for markets abroad. It was interesting to notice a little while before his death, Stalin in Russia was saying that although the Communist Party running Russian capitalism had in the beginning looked only to foreign trade as a means of providing them with things they couldn't get otherwise, he said the time had come when industry in Russia and the other countries in Eastern Europe were finding it necessary to acquire markets abroad for their additional products. This is in fact what happened. They're looking for markets. They're also, of course, looking for cheap sources of raw materials. A lot of countries, from time to time, get liberated. Happy the country which never has friends to come and liberate it. Nigeria, a few years ago, a lot of oil discoveries in different parts of Nigeria. And this was one of the factors sparking off the civil war in Nigeria, oil. And you get the usual lineup of countries. One lot of countries supplying arms to federal Nigeria to kill black Africans in Biafra. And the other lot, a lot of the left, so-called left-wingers, wanted to supply arms to Biafra to kill black Africans in federal Nigeria. What was this but a capitalist war? It is quite true that the two sides exploited tribal differences. They always do. If a war is in the offing, they will always find justifications, language, religion, different tribal, national groupings and all the rest of it. The third thing is, of course, that capitalism in relation to war, having all capitalist powers are expansionist, the only difference between the small and the large is the larger ones have got bigger armaments. They're all expansive, they're all looking for defensible frontiers, as they would say, and having got a defensible frontier, they then look further on. As a last point on this, of course, it was announced 2 or 3 months ago that there were reputed large discoveries, or possible discoveries of oil, off the coast of South Vietnam. Well, I'm not being unduly cynical when I say it may have a good deal to do with the latest phases of the war in Vietnam, and this is true of capitalism generally. You get socialism, you no longer have this search for markets because you do not have a market economy, whatever it may be called. You do not have goods produced to be sold at a profit. You do not have these thrusting groups trying to gain advantage the one over the other. But this is the history of capitalism. Capitalism and war are inseparable.
Mr. Harley has no world of his own to defend. He speaks to a utopia that doesn't exist and will never exist. Of course the world is full of nightmares, but how can you claim that the war between Arab and Jew, for instance, is a capitalist war? It's a war about... But it isn't a capitalist war. It's a war about national identities and ethnic identities and possession of territory. It's got nothing to do with profit. How can you claim that the expansionist attitudes of Russia today, with huge submarine, nuclear submarine fleet, which can only have aggressive purposes, have no nuclear, have no defense purposes at all, is capitalist. Admittedly, Mr. Hardy calls us all capitalist. Even, I believe, China is called capitalist. But until the world is a very, very, very different place, we shan't make it so. Countries will wish to be ready to defend themselves. The United Nations has not begun to make the world safe to be without arms.
Would you like to answer the second part
of the question? Oh yes, well, the hydrogen test is I suppose, better than it might be if there weren't some sort of a treaty. There is some sort of a treaty that limits the amount of tests, so that there are fewer of them than there would be if there weren't a treaty. But in a world in which, at any one time, there are imperialist powers, and at the moment those powers are communist powers, Russia in particular, countries are bound to defend themselves.
Mr. Harding, would just like to make a brief thing about pollution and the hydrogen.
Well, on the pollution and the business generally, of course, well, get the thing in proper perspective. Among all the things that capitalism has made possible, things that could be useful, there's also produced, of course, all these things that are not useful. We are now getting to a point where capitalism not only destroys world resources in wartime, it's now destroying them in peacetime, and this is becoming a major problem. If I may just throw in one last word, by the way, reference is made to Russia and China and the extreme possibility that we might even say that China's capitalist. The Chinese and the Russians are supposed to be two horses out of the same stable. We never accepted this, of course. When the communists got power in Russia in 1917, the Socialist Party said, look, Socialism is not possible. There are no people in Russia to speak of who want socialism. Russia is semi-feudal. They are going to develop capitalism. And incidentally, Lenin said to the Russian workers, what you want, state capitalism. Why the Russian workers wanted state capitalism, nobody knows. Lenin's government wanted it. But to come right up to date, now China has grown to similar size and is threatening Russia's position. And what do the Chinese say? The Chinese say that there were 1 million Russian troops spread out on the Russian frontier. And they mutually accuse each other. The Chinese say that Russia is capitalist and fascist, and the newspapers in Moscow say that the Chinese are capitalist and fascist. Well, we don't have to get ourselves involved in this. China and Russia, like all the other powers, behave like capitalist powers because they are capitalist powers.
I see Mr. Blitz at the back.
The system is the system is the worst system yet invented, except all the others. I don't have to say it's perfect. It's the system that's most likely and has visibly increased prosperity more than any other. It's the capitalist countries, I mean not Mr. Hardy's state capitalist countries, but the market countries, like Canada, like Holland, like Germany, like France, like to a poor extent ourselves, where poverty is far less than in the state capitalist countries. And the poor man has far less chance, far less chance. The poor man has far more chance of emerging from poverty in a market society than in any other. That's why, for instance, the countries that have almost eliminated poverty. Scandinavia has used market mechanisms. There's practically no poverty there. But I repeat that for a country like ours, which still has a very great deal of poverty, I think we may have to have a minimum, a reverse income tax to bring everybody up to a minimum level.
Do I ask any more questions? The gentleman at the back there.
It can't in this country because we tried to run too fast. Successive governments, particularly the Tory government, tried to go too fast and spend too much for what was thought to be good, and we've overdone it, and now we're living with this Labour government on very, very large loans from overseas, and we shall have to have a cut in our standard of living. That's the result, not of the capitalist system. It's the result of trying to run too fast by creating too much demand and bringing about inflation. The rest of the world, the Western world largely is going to boom while we're getting out of our troubles.
Well, I would like to question this last statement about the rest of the world going into boom, after all. Unemployment in Canada, very heavy unemployment in Canada, in Yugoslavia, Australia, Germany, all over the world, capitalism is moving into a situation where, for the time being, unemployment exists there in a state of crisis. But if I look at the motor car industry, too many cars have been produced, they can't be sold. Quite irrespective of what country it's in, or the nature of the way in which it's organized. This is capitalism, and capitalism periodically runs into to depression, because the capitalists, including government, depend on profit. And if circumstances arise where profit prospects disappear, there is a cutback, and workers are stood off, and you get motor cars all over the world, and ships, and tankers, and so on, and not being able to be sold. So get the thing in perspective. It's not just this country. They're all in the same boat, including Sweden, by the way. They're having their troubles. They all will. But reference is made to inflation, suggesting, of course, that it is the Labour government, in their efforts to run capitalism, which has landed in very acute inflation, and this is one of the troubles. I would like to remind you all, how did the Labour Party get into this inflationary business? In the same way the Tories and Liberals got into it. They swallowed this Keynesian myth. They said we can manage capitalism. And I have to put in a word in defence of Keynes. I'm quite sure had Keynes been alive now, he would have been rather shocked at some of the vulgar interpretations given to his views. He was wrong basically, but he did not say what the Labour Party and others took out of it. They acquired the view that all you've got to do to prevent unemployment is to pump money into capitalism. And of course, all that you do when you do this, is you create inflation.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, who was the man who understood inflation? Marx. I mean, nobody knows anything about Marx. I've been in universities lately. I did some lectures at one university where I was dealing with Marx's monetary theories, and three lecturers said they'd come and didn't. And one of them said, I never knew there were any Marx's monetary theories. These are the seats of learning. They, Marx was pushed out by Keynes, and they do not understand one of capitalism's basic problems, that is inflation. They do not understand that if you pump money into capitalism, you shove up prices. They've only got to look at history to see that this is, in fact, what has happened. So they're all in the same boat. It's not just a labor government problem. And incidentally, perhaps, occasion arises, Sir Keith Joseph may tell me exactly how the Tory party proposed to deal with this. You see, for 30 years, they have all been Keynesians. We never had been. We said Marx understood capitalism, and Marx understood inflation, among other things. But I did read that Sir Geoffrey Howe in the House of Commons last week said, we are all monetarists now. Well, I rather gather that he's jumping the gun, that parts of the Tory party would not subscribe to this, but we would say that it doesn't matter either way. Keynes couldn't make capitalism work satisfactorily, neither could free trade nor protection, nor being in or out of the European economic community, and monetarism will not save it. In fact, if they do all become monetarists, they can count us out, that they will merely be putting capitalism back to what it was in the 19th century.
I think maybe it's that.
With respect, I don't think that's true. There are plenty of wealthy countries that have never had colonies. It is the buying power of countries like Sweden and Switzerland and Britain that has given an opportunity for the poorer countries of the world to become less poor. We started off as an underdeveloped country. There are countries that were poor 20 years ago that have made themselves far less poor now. And the countries that have used the market system, like Malaysia, like Singapore, are doing a very great deal better for their people than the countries that have used state capitalist systems, like Ceylon. This is you shake your head. The poorest countries in the world will never escape from their poverty by state capitalism. They've got corrupt governments seeking power, and they depend for their escape from poverty on mutual trade with the richer countries like us. We are their way to increasing their prosperity.
I have only one brief reference to make, and of course it would not satisfy the questioner, because we have nothing, we can't do anything at the moment. But I would remind you of this, that on our conception of running the world on a basis of mutual cooperation, there will be no poor and rich countries or poor and rich people. Which, of course, somebody will say this is utopian.
Well, it is.
Well, right, it's utopian. But as I said before, you either set yourself to this task of doing this, or you are stuck with the ruthless capitalism that you have got at present.
Gentleman with the white paper.
Well, I don't believe in the Marx theory of value. I don't think a worker is the full product of the sale, because the worker producing something, because workers cannot produce wealth by themselves. Wealth is not just mere production. Wealth is production to meet demand. And in order for wealth to be produced, there have to be people called entrepreneurs, who at the risk to themselves identify demand and seek to satisfy it. In order to seek to satisfy it, they mobilize managers, salesmen, manufacturing workers, laboratory technicians, advertising agents, and all the rest. And it is the joint team effort, with some people taking more risk than others, that produces wealth. As for the negative income tax, as some people cannot, for reasons partly of the market and largely market, for reasons to some extent affecting their own skills and capacities,
earn enough to look after themselves and their families, they need help in some way. And the negative income tax is the most civilized way of providing it, without means so.
Well, my brief comment on this, of course, is that as socialists, we would have only one comment to make about negative income tax and all the other devices for doing, so to speak, some industrial Red Cross work under capitalism. All through its history, capitalism has produced an army of destitute people, unemployed or people destitute for other reasons. The paupers, although the word pauperism is no longer needed, that's capitalism, and you're not going to get rid of it after you've got rid of capitalism. But there is one thing that I must correct about this. Reference is made to Marxist theory of value and about who produces. Well, let's clear up the confusion. Wealth is produced by the workers. Well, I said at the beginning, the wage and salary earners, this is the whole lot. There are no people, as is suggested, who are workers and then somebody else who helps with production. These somebody else are workers. The managers, the technicians, the salesmen, the office staff, all the rest of them, they are all members of the working class, wage and salary earners. Wealth is produced by the working class as a whole in a country like Great Britain. I leave out, of course, the peasant countries where some circumstances are different. But I must also correct one thing about Marx and the theory of value. It's a common misconception. People think, many of them, that Marx's theory of value was a theory about what workers ought to be paid. It wasn't. Marx was really looking at capitalism and said, if you want to understand why workers are paid what they are, why there are differences, why one type of work gets paid more than another, why workers in different countries get more than another, this is my theory, this explains it. Marx wasn't saying this is what ought to be. Marx had a simple answer for this. Marx said, abolish the wages system. Don't have any wages system. It's a common and unfortunate misunderstanding about what Marx was after. Marx wanted to get rid of capitalism. But in the meantime, he did this enormously valuable work of saying to you, this is how capitalism works. And one of the things is the variations of wages.
What I would like to propose now is we have a little under one half of an hour. I know that Sir Keith, and I also understand that Mr. Hardy would be anxious to meet students and other members on a more personal level to discuss rather than have this unnatural sort of question and answer game. Therefore, what I propose now is that we finish the question and that I call on each of the speakers to make a brief summation on what has transpired, and that we then adjourn those who are motivated to do so into the common room, where you can approach those people who you would like to discuss, put questions to, or what have you. I hope that this is going to be in agreement with you, because I'm not going to ask your consent. And let's call on to Keith.
Four short points. May I say that I liked Mr. Hardy much more now than I did when he started. I didn't know him then. I think he's charming. And very, very, very within his context rational. But dear me, how easy it is to argue for a system that is purely notional. He doesn't have to defend the iniquity of any country. He can defend every society. He's just talking, it seems to me, with great respect to him as a man, high in the sky. One cannot get a room full of children to agree. One cannot get two trade unions in the same industry to agree. How on earth can one get all the people in a country to agree exactly what to produce or do, let alone the people of the Middle East, let alone the people of the world? Third point, Marx was wrong on his great predictions. He was a powerful analyst, great power in his use of words and analysis. But he was wrong in his forecast of immiseration, the increasing wretchedness of the wage earners, and he never, it seemed to me, overcame the problem to which Mr. Hardy does refer, the problem of accumulation. For the production of tomorrow, there has to be saving from today. To build a house for the child that is being born now, somebody has to save money today. Now, the saver is also the owner. And Marx left no room for the owner. The owners in our society are largely the pension funds, the insurance companies. They provide our investment mechanism. And Mr. Hardy makes no room in his utopia for the private owner, who is part of the production mechanism, because it's the owner's willingness to take risks that ensures
in the market system as opposed to the state capitalist system, that on the whole, investment will occur to produce and supply what people in this imperfect world demand, and not what they are given by a number of bureaucrats at the center.
Well, in making my brief final contribution, I must refer to the point that has been made. I conceded it's a very valid point made by Sir Keith Joseph, and that is to say that he has got to defend this shocking theme that we have got,
that's right,
capitalism. We as socialists, as he would say, are in a favorable position. We don't defend, we are trying to get the human race to look forward and now demand it. Look at the history of the human race. Every advance in human history was, so to speak, looking into the future and trying to do something in the future without having those guidelines already laid down. They all had to do it. Capitalism was only a notion when it began. Capitalism wasn't written down in a book, so to speak, for the capitalists to apply fully fledged. They had to work it out. Indulged in long struggles and battles and sought out all sorts of difficulties and theories. The abolition of slavery, so to speak, was a leap in the dark. We're saying to you, look, don't be afraid. It's a shocking experience to be hit by an idea, but it doesn't do you any permanent injury. Show some courage about this, and again, as I say, if you don't do this, if you're not going to look to the future, you have got to look at this grim world that's around you and say, that's what we're stuck with. Try to get out of it. But there was one other point I want to make, which is more of our line, about the methods of improving capitalism. Liberal Tories and the Labour Party have all set out on this job of improving capitalism. Evidence capitalism is here. I noticed in a speech made by my opponent last October, he referred to that great Tory reformer, Robert Peel. Back over 100 years ago, they were all trying to improve capitalism. They intervened, for example, in the middle of the century to improve housing. They found shocking housing conditions under capitalism for great masses of the workers. They've gone on looking for various things. Well, particularly this refers to the Labour Party. At the beginning of the century, the Labour Party decided deliberately that socialism was not practicable at the moment, so let's deal with practical things. And they named them, housing. They haven't solved the housing problem. All three of those parties haven't solved it. The problem's still there. The standard of housing may be better, but the problem hasn't been solved. Unemployment, they haven't solved unemployment. Not the slightest chance of doing it. They haven't abolished crises. And as Lloyd George once said in his most candid moment, Lloyd George once made a speech in which he said, trouble with reforms is, no sooner have you solved one than another one comes along. And it's even worse than Lloyd George thought, because all those original problems are still here, and now, of course, we've got the additional ones. The racial problem, the population problem, as they call it, the pollution problem. All of these problems are adding up. But my last point is this. Keir Hardie, the father of the Labour Party, the man who worked, as he said, to build, make the Labour Party a Marxist party, to get socialism as Marx and we understood it, and has produced what you know. Keir Hardie said their first priority, they couldn't deal with socialism immediately, their first priority was disarmament. They were going to tackle the problem of disarmament so that in a peaceful world, all the well-meaning people could get on with improving capitalism. Need I tell you what happened? 2 world wars and 100 other wars afterwards, disarmament. Whatever the destructive capacity of armaments was when Keir Hardie made this statement in 1907, I give you your guess, I suppose about 100,000 times as much now, and not the slightest chance of it being done. That is capitalism. So we say to you, if somebody says to you socialism is utopian, we would throw something back at you. The utopians are the people who, after all this experience and in spite of all the evidence, still think that they can do something with capitalism. You can't, you've got to go for socialism.
Just before you... you go, just before you all start moving, you've all been very good. I would like, finally, to thank both our speakers for coming along, and I would ask you to join with me in showing your appreciation. Thank you. Thank you very much.